their strategy for propaganda isn't look how good we are. It's more like, hey, look how evil Israel is.
We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
Here I am.
Here I am.
And here I am.
Here I am.
And here I am.
And here I am. We shall never die.
My guest today is a Muslim American U.S. Army veteran. He used to work at the Muslim American Leadership Alliance. He's the founder and CEO of the American Peace Committee, has a blog on Times of Israel, leads interfaith dialogues initiatives, and somehow just a very optimistic guy. So I'm very glad to say here I am with Dan Kahn.
Yeah, thank you so much, Shai. I trimmed my nose hairs to be here, so you can say I'm very excited.
You trimmed your nose hair to be here?
Yeah.
We could get to that. We could get to that. But Dan, I'm going to start with the question that I ask every non-Jewish ally who comes on this show. Dan, what are you fighting for?
Such a complex question. So I think we should be careful of people who say they have nothing to gain, because in reality, people have stuff to gain from having allies, from doing stuff outside of their communities, whether it's monetary, whether it's social media influence. As for me, I have a lot to gain. I have everything to gain by doing this. I do this because my wife is Jewish and we're going to raise our kids Jewish, and they're going to see me many years in the future from now, recordings of me doing the same thing, speaking out for them, speaking out for their existence, showing up where Jews are being discriminated against, fighting for them, fighting for people who right now are being visually, like actually oppressed in terms of being physically assaulted on the streets, discriminated against in academia. It's terrible. And when my kids see this, they see me fighting for them, however long in the future, I know they're going to be proud. They're going to say, wow, look at that. That's Dad. Like, he has all his hair. And oh my God, he's so cool. He's so young. He doesn't have wrinkles, but he's out there fighting for us. And just to imagine that in my head, it makes me really happy. It makes me like feel like I'm doing the right thing. That's why I do it.
There's no right answer to this question. We could all be fighting for a million different reasons, but that is, I have to say, a perfect answer, fighting for the future of what your kids will look at. And I'll get to that. There's a lot of things I want to get to, but I actually want to start in the beginning. Where were you born? When did you get to the U.S.?
I was born in a small mountain village in Pakistan, somewhere along the border of Afghanistan. And it's impossible to find on Google Maps. I've tried a million times. My brother knows how to do it because like he's been there more recently than I have. I was born there, no running water. Closest hospital is a day's drive, like a legitimate hospital with tile floors and elevators. It's about a day's drive through mountains, not even like get on I-95 and drive south of Florida. No, it's like treacherous mountain terrains, and there's YouTube videos calling those roads the most dangerous roads in the world. And I'm like, that's terrifying. And there were so many instances where, you know, either I could have died at childbirth, I could have died shortly after from some preventable disease, but I was born in a tiny place in Pakistan. And I came to the United States when I was 3 years old. We originally came to Dallas, Texas. I loved it. I have cowboy boots on right now. I have a tattoo of a cowboy with like a skull on my arm. I don't know, a lot of Southern pride in me for only being in Texas for like a short amount of time. But yeah.
What year was this?
This was 1999.
And you have an older brother?
Yep. Older brother and older sister. Mm-hmm. Sister's the oldest, brother's the middle child. And he's excelled in everything. Right now he's a RN and he does amazing stuff. He's working like 16-hour shifts every single day. And it's amazing, like having grown up with him, somebody like that who's so hardworking. My sister is a lot like me, where I'm very laid back. I'm like, do the most amount of, well, least amount of work for the most amount of gain, right? Because I'm like, that's how stuff should be done. It's like, I'm lazy. So my brother can do the hard stuff. I'm going to take a little, you know, chill pill and just hang out.
I don't think you're lazy. And when people look at the things you've done, I don't think anyone would call you lazy. And that is another thing I want to get to. But before that, I do have to ask, the reason I bring up older siblings is your family moved here in 1999. You're too young probably to remember. You're 3 years old. 2 years later, 9/11 happens. How did it affect your family as newly immigrated family to the U.S., Muslim Americans?
We didn't know what was happening because my parents loved the United States. They were very happy to be here. My siblings also loved it. We loved going to school in Texas. It was amazing. And I don't remember the day exactly, but I remember school ending early and our parents coming to pick us up early. And it wasn't a normal half day because for half days for students, you kind of look forward to it. You know what's happening. You know it well in advance because you've been in school for a few years. And, you know, you're anticipating. But this, it was just out of nowhere. Tons of parents flooding the parking lot, picking up kids. There was crying. There was commotion. It wasn't normal. It felt like the vibe was completely off that day. And we get home, and my parents are watching the news, and my siblings and I are just, you know, hanging out, trying to ask our parents, like, hey, what's going on? And that's really all I remember. But after that, living in Texas for new immigrants, my parents had thick accents, and they struggled to find work after that. They struggled to find work. They struggled to make friends. They faced harassment when they went out because my mom wore a hijab. And my dad is visibly Pakistani. He looks more Arabic than he does Pakistani, like, because it's more towards Afghanistan. But people could tell, like, hey, these are immigrants. They're brown. They have little brown kids. And the hatred was really, really palpable in Texas right after it happened. So it was because of that we moved to New York City.
Do you remember how your parents mediated that to you, to explain to you what's going on in the world and why you have nothing to do with this, but all of a sudden you're a target?
Yeah, it was explained through what Islamophobia is considered to be. These people are afraid of Muslims. They're afraid of different cultures. They're racist, xenophobic, whatever it is. That's how they explained it.
You moved to New York City, and how was the move?
It was scary. We hopped in our tiny little 2001 Ford Escort, tiny little car. Back then, it seemed like
a normal
car. I used
to have a Ford Escort.
They're okay. Tiny. And now, like, come on, I'm not a small guy. And I was this size in high school. So after a little bit, like, it became a really tiny car. But we piled in that car. We packed up all our stuff in a little U-Haul trailer. And we made our way up. I remember some things. Like, I remember lakes and rivers and giant semi-trucks. And me and my brother would be fighting in the back seat. And my mom would be like, stop fighting. You're going to distract your dad. And he's going to crash. And we're all going to die. And I'm like, that's a little exaggerated, but okay, we'll stop fighting. So it was a lot of fun. We made a few pit stops, stopped at motels, but it was a fun little road trip up here.
And when you got to New York City, and I assume it was a very different experience, what was it like being a Muslim American Pakistani kid, an immigrant after 9/11 in New York City?
It was a lot easier than Texas, mm-hmm. A lot easier. The mobility for a person to get around New York City, fantastic. As a kid, you could hop on the train and then you're like, in an hour, you're like 10, 15 miles away from home. It's fantastic. Compared to, like, if you're a 5-year-old in Texas, you can't get anywhere. Mm-hmm. And I, for the first time, saw other Pakistani kids. Because in my school in Texas, the only kids that looked like me were Mexican. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times other people thought we were Mexican, and we'd be like, no, we're Pakistani. We just happen to look almost identical, you know, like short. We'd have like little buzz cuts and yeah, little short brown kids. We looked pretty Mexican. And I was like, okay, cool. They look like me. But then coming here, seeing Pakistani, Indian, South Asian, whatever, I'm like, wow, like these are our people. They live in the same place as us. They live in apartment buildings. They live in houses. They're everywhere. It felt really cool. Mm. Yeah, felt like home.
And then you went to school. You graduated. At what point did you decide to join the U.S. military?
So it was a little earlier than some people would think. I actually wanted to join the Army and like made up my mind when I was 13.
13?
When I was 13. And I knew I couldn't pack up and leave my house and, you know, just hop on a bus and join the Army then. But at 13 years old, I knew what I wanted to do was be in the military. And every country and every military has propaganda. Like the movie Top Gun. That is propaganda. And the U.S. Navy actually thanked Top Gun for extreme recruitment numbers. After Top Gun, the first one came out, giant spike in recruitment by the Navy. It was fantastic. But what is it? It wasn't just a simple movie. It's in part funded by the U.S. military. Mm. They received Department of Defense dollars to help make that movie. They receive airplanes. They receive training. They receive consultants from the military to help make that possible. So I, as a 13-year-old, in some way, fell for that propaganda.
What was the movie that you felt for?
It was, I don't remember what movie it was exactly, but I played a lot of Call of Duty, unfortunately, like every kid back then. But it was just, at one point, it was just, I looked at just movies coming out and I was like, these are fantastic. I love these. And I was more so inspired by stuff from World War II. So there's my favorite book, Catch 22. Mm-hmm. Love it. Fantastic book. I related to it so much when I was actually in the military. But the movie for
Catch 22. That's interesting because Catch 22 is a very critical
book
and film. Yeah. About any military, in fact.
As it should be. I think we should be critical of the military. We should be critical of the government. Nobody's perfect. Nobody. Not the United States, not Israel. We shouldn't pretend that, you know, as human beings and stuff created by humans and run by humans, can't assume that anything's perfect. But you still love it. With all its flaws, I still love the military.
Right, because like some people that be listening in, if they haven't canceled you already and logged off, they would think like, oh, he's talking about propaganda. He's talking about Catch 22. He probably hates the fact that he was in the military. He's like, but right before we started recording, you talked about how you owe everything to the U.S. military and how proud you are.
Walk me
through that line of thinking.
Yeah. So we have to be transparent. We have to be honest with ourselves and each other. Stuff that exists in media and outside in the world like that is propaganda. And when you see pro-American stuff, like the movie American Sniper that came out while I was in the military, went to go see it, and I saw it and I was like, this is propaganda. And my Army buddies were like, what do you mean? Like, you can't say that. It was an awesome film. I'm like, yeah, it was an awesome film. Bradley Cooper was fantastic. They have like a baby doll that's extremely fake, and it's like a meme now of how fake that baby is, because it's literally like a $10 doll from like Toys R Us, and then Bradley Cooper's like puppeting it, making it look real, but it's really fake. So yeah, it's propaganda. When we see pro-Israel stuff, even it is true and it's fantastic, you know, we're seeing aid to Gaza, we're seeing help from Israelis, and it's fantastic, but at the end of the day, this is all propaganda. And there's a saying, it's like a little story. A KGB agent and a CIA agent were having a beer one day. And the CIA agent says, I love your propaganda. It's fantastic. And the KGB agent says, yeah, your propaganda is fantastic too. I love it. And the CIA agent goes, what propaganda? We don't have propaganda. And it's like the CIA agent is so like brainwashed as well that he doesn't know that the pro-American stuff that he's been fed his whole life is in fact propaganda. And it seems like a word that's a bad word, but it's not a bad word. It's just a label. We're not saying that propaganda is bad. It's just a label to describe a piece of media that's being put out there.
So how do you, you know, how do you differentiate between like the bad, you know, capital P propaganda and the more educational, informative, you know, the positive, what you would call propaganda?
Yeah, if a piece of media is aligned to discriminate against somebody, discriminate or put down other people, to belittle people, that's something we've seen on the pro-Hamas side a lot, where their strategy for propaganda isn't as much as look how good we are. It's more like, hey, look how evil Israel is, or look how evil Zionists are, look how evil Jews are, look how evil the United States is. That's been their propaganda with a capital P. That's been anti-Semitic, hateful rhetoric that they've been pushing. Better propaganda is like, hey, look how fantastic we can do things. Oh, look at all these aid trucks that are moving somewhere. Look at all, you know, the eyes we have on civilians that are being helped. That's a better way to show it. And I've seen the difference between Jewish media and pro-Hamas media, where one side, the Jewish side, is all positive, and it's all about empathy. It's about respect, being allowed to live, without being hated, living in peace with other people, while the pro-Hamas side is all about kill, discriminate, and also look at us, we're the victims. Help us, we're very victimized, but also we have amazing things. Yeah, there's another thing, kind of going off topic. On Instagram, I came across a page for supercars, because I get like supercars and monster trucks on my Instagram. And I was like, oh, cool. You know, this is a Nissan GTR from like 2022. And then I look at it, I'm like, it says it's in Palestine. And then this supercar account is for car spotting in Palestine, specifically for cars that are more than $100,000. And I'm like, okay, you're showing one thing where the whole area is decimated, all of Gaza is destroyed, all Palestinians are dead, but then you're showing me hotels, and you're showing me luxury apartments, and you're showing me your fancy supercar and all your friends' supercars. That's propaganda. That person doesn't know what side to play, because they're saying, look at us, we're the victims, but also he's saying, check out my fancy car that most Americans can't afford. I would say like 95% of Americans can't afford a $100,000, $200,000 car to knock around. So yeah, that's propaganda for you.
You know, when if someone hears like a clip of what you just said and, you know, doesn't know who you are, makes assumptions, you have a beard, you have like the Star of David and the Bring Them Home dog tag, they'd say, okay, typical Jew, you know, talking about how, quote unquote, the other side is bad, horrible, etc. But then if someone does know that you're not Jewish, you're a Muslim American, U.S. Army veteran, what is the reaction for to someone like you within your community?
The reaction is, oh, that person's not Muslim. That's the first thing they say. The Instagram comments, if somebody on the street, say in Brooklyn, saw my videos, and they would just say, oh, he's not Muslim. He's not actually Muslim. He has tattoos. He's probably been here his whole life, and he doesn't know what he's talking about. He's not actually Muslim. Despite the fact that I eat halal, I pray 5 times a day, especially when I can. If I can't help it, you can't help it. You make up for it in other ways. But I do everything that makes me a Muslim. I don't drink alcohol. And I do more things as a Muslim 365 days a year than people who call themselves Muslim do in Ramadan, which is like the holiest month, which is happening when this is being filmed. They say they're Muslim, and then this is the only time of year where they actually do Muslim stuff. I'm doing it the whole year, every single year, for most of my life. So just because I speak a different way or I have different opinions, they're very quick to say that's not a Muslim. So I
can why do you think that is?
It's really toxic culture. It's the culture behind it. There's the metaphor crabs in a bucket. Mm-hmm. So if you put crabs in a bucket while you're fishing for crabs, you don't have to put a lid on the bucket, because as long as you have two crabs in there, they'll keep each other inside. One crab tries to crawl out of the bucket and he could easily make it. What happens is the other crab grabs him and then pulls him back down, keeping him trapped in a bucket. And the more crabs you have in the bucket, the better. They keep themselves in there. They retain themselves into this hole. They don't know what's happening. They don't know that they're going to go home and, you know, turn it to stew or sold at a market. They don't know that. They just keep each other down. And that's the analogy I use to describe Muslim culture. They don't want to see other people succeed. And the second somebody starts succeeding or doing something different, they're labeled as not a Muslim. They're just not Muslim. Okay, then what am I? I'm not atheist. I'm not Jewish, even though I wear the Star of David, which was a gift from my friend Andy. I do everything as a Muslim. So just because I don't agree with them makes me not a Muslim. It's really toxic.
And in your experience, because obviously polling surveys are complicated, how many people like you are there out there?
So outspoken, I would say about just a handful, but like out of the billion.
And what about, you know, if you got them like anonymously, you know, mm-hmm. behind the scenes, tell me what you really think.
Absolutely. I get DMs from people. So I was at a little speaking event with Mozzie Pillip, who you've had on the show. She's fantastic. We were speaking at Stony Brook together, and there was a protest in the audience towards us. They had little wanted posters made of our faces. It was a little scary, but you know, I stayed calm. Mozzie, you know, former IDF, so she's like a soldier right there with me. So I felt very safe. Thankfully, the police was also there, and they escorted them out afterwards. But after this event, because I spoke at the event about empathy constantly, like we need to be empathetic and understanding. When they would interrupt me to speak over me, I would stop. I'd cross my arms, cross my hands, be like, okay, I'm going to let them speak. I'm going to let them read their notes, because they were reading off like cue cards. Mm. Read your thing. And then after they were done, I said, thank you. I thanked them. I said, you're heard. You're seen. I believe you. I believe that these are things you believe. And then I just made my counterpoint, and then that was it. After that event, people reached out to me anonymously through my DMs and my little email. They messaged me saying, hey, I was one of the protesters. I was one of the students there. I didn't agree with the pro-Israel stuff, but thank you for being respectful. Thank you for hearing us out. And I was like, this is fantastic. This is a step in the right direction. I don't need them to be super pro-Israel. I don't need them to be pro-Israel at all. Just as long as they're not super hateful, as long as they're not violent, as long as they're not anti-Semitic, that's a step in the right direction. So I would say the majority of Muslims are peaceful. The issue is they're controlled by the small minority that is extremely violent. And those extreme people have ingrained themselves in higher positions in government and in positions of authority like law enforcement, the military. So if you speak out, or if there's even a hint that your opinions differ, it's not like here in the United States where they just call me non-Muslim. There, it's a death sentence. So they're terrified. They would be killed. Their family would be sent to a labor camp. That would be it. So the billions of Muslims out there, they're terrified.
So how do we change the script?
I don't think it's going to happen in our lifetime. I think this is a problem that's existed for centuries, and it's going to exist for a little bit longer than we're going to be alive, but we can really push it in the right direction. We have to uplift voices of peace, voices of coexistence. My whole thing is that I don't want people to agree. I want people to disagree. I want everybody to disagree on fundamental things, because a true peaceful society isn't one that's homogenous in thinking. It's one that has diverse ideas, but lives with those diverse ideas and opinions peacefully. When we're not at each other's throats, when we're not trying to burn down synagogues, when we're not bombing each other, when we're not going tit for tat like it's some sort of video game, that's, you know, that's going to be something better. That's really what we're working towards. And when you and I have this conversation, and hopefully it inspires other people to come to the table, to be, hey, I'm not going to agree with you on stuff, but I'm going to listen to you. And that's all we have to do. We have to live with each other. We have to listen to each other. We just can't be violent about it.
But unfortunately, there are many violent elements mm-hmm. right now in society. And you wrote a very interesting, I'd call it an op-ed, called My Generation Failed in Activism, mm-hmm. which is very interesting, because it resonates with me, and I think with many people. And I'm just over 10 years older than you. I'm 16 years older than you. But I feel like I couldn't say that, because it would be like the older guy saying, you guys don't know what activism is. Mm-hmm. But you're talking about my generation. So meaning your generation failed in activism. So what is that failure, and why are we there?
So it's a failure because we're advocating for stuff that isn't peaceful, and we're doing it in a means that causes violence and is just inherently destructive. That's not activism. Activism isn't attacking people or berating them. That's just, it's terrorism and bullying. That's what's happening on campuses and on the street. I hope that we can move past that to actual activism, where, you know, we have to file permits. We have to get permission to be on the street, having actual security there to stop extremists from doing things, writing letters, contacting politicians. Voting is extremely important to me for mostly local elections, because local elections is where the change happens. And we know with the Electoral College, that's a whole nother podcast.
Yeah.
Oh my God. But,
and hopefully not mine, because that's a cancelable offense.
Oh my God. Yeah. The true activism is not what we've seen. My generation has unfortunately been very susceptible to the wrong type of propaganda, one fueled by hate. And they've used their energy in non-constructive ways to demean, demoralize, put down other people, especially when it comes to faith. If you're going to do that, if it's something like, if a person's like a mass murderer, okay, cool, like the protest is going to look a little bit different than if you're, going out and trying to burn down a synagogue. That's not protesting. And those are young people doing stuff like that. Mm. Those are young people at college campuses who are encamped, who are assaulting other students, who are assaulting police officers and security staff, destroying buildings on campuses. That's not activism. It's a failure.
Let me play devil's advocate.
Okay.
And I say that in advance, because I do not agree with what I'm about to say, but because you like to disagree, and I do too. Younger people might say, no, that's exactly activism. What we have been doing, or previous generations have been doing in the past, is not working. If you don't take over buildings, if you don't act in a more dominant, violent manner, nothing changes. So yes, voting is important, but, you know, we want a fundamental change of the entire system. You know, they call it the system of oppression that needs to be burnt down.
Mm-hmm. When they say something like that, I'm going to do exactly what I did now. I'm going to listen to every single word they said, and I'm going to take it seriously. I think that's one of the issues of older generations, and even people in my generation. We aren't taking each other seriously. And when people say stuff like that, it's written off. And when somebody doesn't feel like they're being taken seriously, they're going to resort to more extreme actions. They're going to show you through their actions, hey, you need to take me seriously. So when someone says something like that, I encourage people to be like, hey, I hear you. And I believe what you're saying. Like, that's something you believe. So yeah, going to that point, I completely disagree, because in the long run, it is making their effort meaningless. People are looking down at them. They're not seeing them as people worth listening to. When they resort to violence, the media completely changes the narrative. The media is going to portray them as violent protesters who don't have real demands, who aren't worth listening to. But if they came to the table peacefully, if they came to a negotiation and actually spoke at a human level without resorting to violence, they would be taken very seriously. They'd be like, hey, I'm somebody worth listening to. I don't want to damage property. I don't want to resort to extremist stuff. Like, hear me out. That does work compared to when they go out and they destroy stuff. They're going to just be seen as vandals. They're not going to be taken seriously. Mm. And that's what's happened with Trump calling Gaza, Gaza Lago, or like all the Trump means of him taking over the Gaza Strip. We can thank the pro-Palestinian protesters for that. I thank them for that, because the pro-Pali people are the ones that made that happen. It is because the pro-Palestinian people weren't willing to listen to us, to listen to peaceful voices that they disagree with. Instead, they resorted to taking over buildings. It is because of them that Trump was able to say, hey, cool, these are just extremists. These are just people not worth listening to. We're going to write them off. We're not going to listen to a single word they're saying. They're not going to be negotiated with. They're not going to have any say in what's happening. We're going to do whatever we want. That's what happens when you take over buildings. That's what happens when you resort to violence. People aren't going to listen to you.
So, yeah, I mean, the reaction to extremism from one end is an extremism from the other end. Mm-hmm. I think there's another thing that might be going on, which is, at least in my experience, even when they do pretend to engage in a more peaceful manner, there is this feeling that if you do not agree with every one of my demands, mm-hmm. then you are not listening to me. Whereas the disagreement can there's no space for disagreement. There's no space for me to say, you know what, I heard your arguments and I refute them. Some of them, all of them, many of them. I accept some of your demands or requests, but not others. But the problem is that it's almost like an all or nothing. You accept everything, you'll divest, you'll do whatever we want, or we'll keep fighting till the end. Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, they're going to learn the hard way that you have to negotiate with each other when you're an adult. When you're an adult, you can't just have everything your way. So on my drive here, I wasn't allowed to just knock people off the road. I had to let people merge. I wasn't able to just cut people off all willy-nilly.
We're in New Jersey. In New York, you're allowed more, but yeah.
Driving's a whole other thing. Oh, my God. So when we come to things like that, when you're an adult, you have to negotiate. You have to meet people halfway. When, you know, if you make a demand, you make it a little bit higher, like in Shark Tank, you ask for $50,000, even though you'll settle for like $25,000. It's like that. You make a demand, but you have to be willing to negotiate. And when they don't, they lose everything. Because their mentality of all or nothing, they're going to get nothing. Because they're not in positions of power. They're not in government. Right now, it's Trump's administration. Right now, the college administrations are they're putting their foot down. They're taking it more seriously. These people are going to lose everything because they didn't negotiate, because they weren't willing to say, hey, we'll give a little bit, we'll take a little bit, tit for tat. It works like that in real life. So they're going to learn.
So now I feel like I know why you founded American Peace Committee. Mm-hmm. Now I want to get to, what is American Peace Committee? What do you do in the organization? What's your goal for it?
Yeah, absolutely. The American Peace Committee, I founded it because I was seeing what the organization I worked at, MALA, it was very Muslim-centric. They wanted to focus more on Muslims. And I saw with Jewish organizations, they just do that. But with Jews, is they're focusing on their Jewish constituency. And you do that because it makes sense. That's where you get the donations from. That's your population. Those are the people that support you. So you're going to do that. So I wanted a middle ground. I wanted a middle ground where it's not tied to a religious ideology or political ideology. With American Peace Committee, the only thing that you have to be is American, if that, because I want to have ambassadors all over the world for American Peace Committee. I want to have my friends in Saudi Arabia who are very pro-Israel, my friends in Morocco who are Muslim, very pro-Israel, very pro-America. You just have to be pro-America, which does not mean pro-Trump or pro-Democrat. It doesn't mean any of that. It just means you love this country. It doesn't matter if you're Black, white, Hispanic. Doesn't matter if you're Muslim, Christian, Jewish. You're an American, and it encapsulates everything you are. It covers, on a broad spectrum, different ideas, different groups of people. And my hope is to bring them together.
So, and what kind of work do you do or plan on doing?
So right now we have like small events through Long Island that we've done, tiny little things. I'm growing it slowly because I don't want it to be too much for me to handle. And during recording, in time of this recording, we're working on getting our 501c3 status so that we can be tax exempt, so we can do even more work and expand. I'm hoping to really use this to have people come to the table, like we've been trying to say, to bring their ideas and their beliefs, to know that they're heard, that people will disagree with them, but they're not going to ostracize them.
And what has been the reaction?
It's been fantastic. It's been fantastic. It's been a little overwhelming because people are really looking forward to stuff. And right now my team is tiny. It's just myself and a handful of people in like a group chat trying to get stuff done. But people love it because when I talk to my friends who are very liberal, those are the exact same ideas that I want in American Peace Committee. When I talk to my friends who are more conservative, I'm like, hey, these are the same things I want people on the left to hear. We have so much in common and we have so many differences, but our differences are only there because we have different ways of achieving the same goal. Mm. We want the same goal, which is a better America. We just have different ways of getting there.
Mm-hmm. Right. That is part of the thing that really amazes me about the United States. And it's partially because of the two-party system, and it's partially because of the identity of politics here. But as someone who came here from the outside, and well, I've been here for 15 years, I still feel a little bit like an outsider. Sometimes I just want to tell people, can't you all see that you all want the same thing? You may disagree on how, but you're fighting. Like, everybody wants safer streets, fewer guns. Everybody wants more liberties. Everybody wants that. Now, you disagree maybe on how but how is that not clear?
It's so obvious. We want to be safer. We want a better economy. We just have politicians who built their careers off of their constituents fighting other people. So that's what American politics is really based off of. It's based off of fear-mongering and just media perpetuating different ideas. It's tough. I hope that, you know, with American Peace Committee, we can show people that we want the same thing.
And so, staying in the same vein, I want to talk about your interfaith initiatives. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you about myself on the end of October 2023, so very early on, my wife and I met a Reform rabbi in Manhattan, and I asked him, can you facilitate a meeting between me and some imams? Because I already felt that things are going on the wrong direction, and this is the opportunity before it gets too late. And the rabbi said something that was very unfortunate. He said, theoretically, I have many people because I've been in many interfaith initiatives and groups. But since October 7th, They have been basically non-existent. Now it's been a year and a half, maybe things are back. But why do you think that's the case, that the fault line here is not democracy versus terrorism, or it's not Israeli versus Palestinian, but it's Jewish versus Muslim?
I think that after my time working at Mala, I saw that all interfaith initiatives pre-October 7th were just for show. They were just cash grabs. They were just to get people together for dinners and interfaith iftar, interfaith Shabbat. It was just for show. It was completely meaningless. Because what is all that interfaith work worth if it hasn't resulted in anything? If it was actual meaningful conversations and community building and learning about each other, being friends, making friends who are different faiths, if it was actually about that pre-October 7th, we wouldn't be in the situation where we are now. Because as far as I know, almost all interfaith programs have been completely defunded.
So how do you build a genuine, devoted interfaith attempt or initiative?
We cut the BS.
I love that. What's the BS?
The BS is, again, pretending like we're all the same. It's pretending like we're homogenous, that we're all friends and we agree on everything. We have so many things in common. That's the BS. Mm-hmm. That's what interfaith programs were pre-October 7th. It's like, look at us, we're all friends. They weren't friends. People at those little conventions, those little dinners weren't friends. They were just dudes in business suits trying to make a quick buck off of Jews and Muslims. Mm. They didn't care about each other. So that's where the BS is. We're going to cut that out. Let's get people together who disagree. Let's get people together who might not like each other, who say like, oh, I don't like what Jews are doing. I don't like what Muslims are doing. Let's get them together. Let's be actually interfaith, acknowledge our differences. Know that it is our differences that make us great. Like, those are the things that make us individuals, that make us Jews and Muslims. We're not all some gray blobs meshed together. We look very different. We act very different. We need to embrace that.
And you walk the walk. So where'd you meet your wife?
Oh, my God. So it all started in 2019. She was just one of my brother's annoying friends. I never thought anything would have come with that. I was like, oh, she's just, you know.
Is your brother annoying or is your wife annoying? Or she was annoying?
They're both annoying.
Okay.
They're both annoying. They went to college together and they're part of like tons of student government things. Again, I'm lazy. So I was like, I'm not doing any of that. I'm doing my homework. I'm going home. I'm coming to school. That's all I'm doing. My brother and her constantly like tons of like school activities where they're having barbecues, they're participating in like graduation services where they like hand out caps and gowns to graduates. They went on like tons of like field trips. And eventually, I didn't have a lot of friends coming out of the Army. All my Army friends either stayed in the Army or went to like their separate ways. We still keep in touch, but you know, my ones from Texas, they're not moving to New York. Like they're not moving to New York, giving up all their guns. They're not doing that. So yeah, me and my Army buddies separated. So I needed new friends. And my brother was like, hey, why don't you come out with me and my friends? And I thought my wife was at that time just my brother's friend. I thought she was just an annoying little person. I'm like, oh, she's cringe. I'm never going to hang out with her. And then eventually we hung out as a group, like five people at a time. Then eventually it was like one-on-one. It was like, hey, we have some stuff in common. Let's hang out as friends one-on-one. And then one night she asks my brother, hey, can I ask out your brother? Like, he seems really cool. We flirt sometimes. He's super nice. And my brother said, no, don't do it. He doesn't like you. He flirts with anybody. And I don't do that. I don't flirt with people. So he was like, he flirts with everybody. That's just him. It doesn't mean anything. And then I like... I actually liked her. So yeah, I don't flirt with people like that. So I actually meant what I was saying to her. And she was like, okay, so I have your permission. I said, yes. And he was like, yeah, sure, go ahead. So she asked me, we were at Medieval Times. We had a little dinner. And then afterwards, she like asked me out on like a formal date. I said, yeah. Yeah, it was fantastic.
And was it ever an issue that she's Jewish and you are Muslim?
Not at all. Now, my family's very accepting. Her family's very accepting. I got very, very lucky. I consider myself one of the luckiest people in the world.
And you don't have kids yet?
Not yet. Not yet, but we're planning it.
And you're planning.
Mm-hmm.
Have you talked about how do you negotiate that interfaith dialogue?
Oh, my goodness. We're going to raise them predominantly Jewish. That's just what I believe. That's what I think is right. But they're going to be raised culturally, both Muslim and Jewish. There's some fantastic cultural aspects of Islam that, you know, I want to bring to the table, that I want to show them, like, hey, look, this is Eid, this is Ramadan, like, not force them into it like I was when I was a kid. I was really forced into doing that stuff against my will. So just, you know, show them. And if they pick a different direction, you know, that's okay too.
I think that sounds perfect. That sounds like, why can't we all?
I don't know. I think it's just, I'm high on openness, and so is my wife. We're very transparent with each other. We're, you know, very secure. We just like hanging out with my best friend.
Now, I want to ask you a question that is related, and when I get a version of this question, it really depends not so much on the question itself, but the intent behind the question. So I want to make sure that you know that the intent is curiosity and true, like, openness and care. Because a lot of people ask me, is anti-Semitism really that bad? And if I say yes and I explain, then they ask, what can we do? So I want to ask you, is Islamophobia right now in the U.S. or in the West really that bad? And if so, what can we non-Muslims do?
So I started out my activism work by fighting Islamophobia. I was taught since I was a little kid that Islamophobia is the worst thing ever. Everybody is Islamophobic. People hate Muslims. For no reason, apparently. I was told this for no reason. Like, they just hate us because they're bad people. And, you know, I was very keen on helping out where I could. And as time went on, I saw that Islamophobia wasn't the real issue. So there's things in Islam and Muslim culture that are problematic. And criticizing Islam is not Islamophobia. Criticizing someone doesn't mean you hate them, doesn't mean you're scared of them, doesn't mean you want to ostracize them. It's good to criticize people. That's how we improve. When people criticize the Prophet Muhammad, when people criticize specific passages in the Quran or Hadiths, they're labeled as Islamophobic. It's like, oh, you're just a xenophobe, you're Islamophobic, you're a terrible person. How could you do that? No, it's just, they're asking questions. They want to know the answer to these things. So they're genuinely asking, and then they get shunned. They're like, hey, no, you're a hateful person, go away. And while Muslims are not a minority in the world, they are a minority in the United States, and they have used that to their advantage, which works because it's like, hey, I'm a minority. You're discriminating against a minority because of my beliefs. Well, if I want to ask questions about specific things that seem problematic, if something seems violent, if people are behaving a certain way, if I have questions about the Prophet Muhammad, his behavior, who he married, we should be allowed to ask that stuff without getting in trouble. So I saw that Islamophobia wasn't what it was made out to be. It really, really relied on Muslims being a minority in America.
But at what point does it cross a line, if ever? I assume there's a line.
Yeah, because there are people like, my family experienced moving out of Texas. People were Islamophobic. 9/11 had just happened. They thought anybody with a Middle Eastern sounding name, was a terrorist. And as a kid post 9/11, I grew up with everybody calling me a terrorist as a joke. Like, that's just something Pakistani and Middle Eastern kids grow up with. Because, you know, kids like joke with each other. They call each other names. That was like their go-to. Even in the army, my like army buddies would say that. But I never take it to heart because I know there are people that actually mean it. They're not going to say it right to my face. The people that mean like you're a terrorist, they're not the ones saying it to me. They're the ones saying it at like their little private dinner. They're the ones saying it while they're passing laws. My friends who are teasing me, calling me a terrorist, they're not the ones who actually have something against me. They're just having fun.
But I'll tell you something. And again, we're treading on, you know, shaky ground, but it's important that we talk about these things. One of the arguments coming from a lot of campus organizations right now around the country is, you call us terrorists, sympathizers, terrorist supporters, whatever, spreading terrorist propaganda. You're calling us that because we are Muslim and or Arab, that is prejudice, that is Islamophobic. I would never want anyone to feel like I am targeting them for who they are, for things beyond their control. What is your reaction to something like that?
Yeah, I think more than one thing can be true at one time. That's the thing about living in this world. It's not black and white. You know, there's gray areas, and somebody can be Muslim and support Hamas. And we've seen tons of evidence of that on social media where people on campuses are not just saying free Palestine or I'm for Palestinians, they're regurgitating pro-Hamas rhetoric. Some of them are actually saying that they're pro-Hamas on camera, and they just happen to be Muslim. Some of them happen to be Muslim. A lot of them aren't Muslim. A lot of them are just college kids who think they're doing the right thing, who are in their minds helping minorities, but they're on camera, recorded all over the internet for everybody to see, being pro-Hamas, not just pro-Palestinian, because I've met tons of Jews and Israelis that are pro-Palestinian, that want Palestinians, that love Palestinians, know a lot of Palestinians, want Palestinians to succeed in every aspect of life. They're just not pro-Hamas. So there's tons of people like that who are pro-Palestinian, but not pro-terror. They're not pro-Hamas. They're not anti-Israel. I think the college students have made that distinction. They've told us that they're pro-Hamas, and we're taking them seriously.
Which brings me to the last question, which is, what is the grifter identification guide?
So this goes back to what I was saying earlier. We need to be careful with who our allies are. We need to be very careful of people that say they don't have anything to gain. Because as for me, I have everything to gain currently and for the future. A lot of what we do relies on positive reinforcement. So whether that's praise on the street or praise in our Instagram comments and DMs, when we open Instagram and we see a flood of likes and comments or views, that's all positive reinforcement going to our brain and, you know, sending chemicals saying, hey, this feels good, keep doing it. So when someone gets caught up in that and they don't really know what they're doing, they might pick a side they don't know everything about. So we've seen that with, I don't know if I'm allowed to name them, but...
You're allowed to do whatever you want. This is not a show where we cancel people, but you're allowed to do... Yeah.
Okay, this one very famous pro-Israel person was walking across a campus in California, I believe, and people thought he was a Zionist, and they like tried to fight him, and like he had his daughter with him, and they, you know, they tried to cancel. They're like, "Hey, are you pro-Zionist? Like, get out of here!" And he was like recording himself. It went very viral. He got a ton of support from the Jewish community, and just a few months ago, turned out that, you know, he never really believed any of this stuff. He had a trip to Israel that was fully paid for. He had tons of stuff. And then there's like pictures of him with like pro-Pali shirts, going back and forth even with unrelated stuff. Like he was pro-Trump and then he was pro-Harris. He was pro-Trump. He was pro-Harris. Like just make up your mind. So we've seen that. And I don't want people who are genuine to feel like they could be next, that they can be attacked as a grifter, because that's going to discourage people from speaking out. If another Muslim person speaks out and people are like, oh, you're just a grifter. People at the little protest against Mazie Pillip and myself, one of the ladies was calling me a grifter. And then I was just like, hey, you got to make money somehow. Just as a little joke. But like, they're going to call you a grifter. And if you can't take it, a lot of people don't have thick skin. A lot of people take these words really true to heart and it tears them apart. They're like, I'm not a grifter. People are calling me names. I'm so sad. My wife is like one of those people who takes things very personally. And she's like, if I was you, I would be crying 24/7. Cause like she's seen like my DMs, my comments, she's seen how like people act, like the videos people have made of me. She's like, if I was you, I'd just be crying. And I'm like, no, I think it's fun. You gotta have fun with it, you know. We're just here for a little while, so can't take everything so seriously. But I'm going off on a tangent. I want people who are true in their beliefs for allies to know what a grifter looks like. For people that we support, for them to know what a grifter looks like. So that they can call people like that out before they get too big and before they use us for our resources just to fund some career they're trying to establish.
So what does a grifter look like?
It looks like they for some reason love GoFundMe. Like it, even
to be fair, we do use GoFundMe for okay, this good. Podcast, that's but that's okay.
That's different. That's different when you're an established, very credited person doing something in like an amazing place like this. That's very different compared to when somebody comes out of the woodwork and doesn't have a plan, doesn't have a team, doesn't have any resemblance of what's going on, and they're immediately like, oh, I have attention. Boom, GoFundMe. Like that's what we saw with the other person. He had several GoFundMes active, accepting donations from Jewish people. That's one of the things of what it looks like. It's just to fund him buying a car or rent money, stuff like that. That's not fruitful. Yeah. That's one of the things where it looks like. It also looks like easily persuaded into things. So their moral convictions aren't very straightforward. They're not on the straight and narrow. They're very wishy-washy. They're all over the place. As we've seen, if someone says they're pro-Israel, yeah, they don't have to be 1,000,000,000% pro-Israel. Israel makes mistakes. You should be allowed to criticize them. But you can't just constantly be back and forth being pro-Palestinian, being pro-Hamas, and then being anti-Israel, and then go back to being pro-Israel. If someone's doing like that, constantly changing beliefs, that should be, you know, decently hard to change. It should require a lot of evidence to change your beliefs if they're that deeply rooted in a topic that's so polarizing. If they change them so easily, they're probably a grifter.
So everyone should be a little bit more alert, but also don't be too suspicious of everyone, because there's a lot of incredible people out there doing a lot of important work for the good reason.
Absolutely. There needs to be a balance. People need to understand that, you know, that some people are actually in it for the right reasons. Mm-hmm. Some people are in it just to fund themselves.
Mm-hmm. All right. So I end every episode with the Here I Am lightning round.
Oh my
and
God.
You get the non-Jewish version. Dan Khan, what is one thing people don't know about you?
Ooh, oh my God, that's tough. I feel like I'm so transparent. I have two cats, Latka and Kofta.
Wait, her name are Latka and Kofta?
Yep. Okay. Latka, just to be the Jewish part of my family. Kofta, the Middle Eastern Muslim part of my family. They're really cute. They're really sweet.
Do they get along together? Is interfaith?
Yeah, they love each other. And again, they're so different. And they still love each other. It's so cute. They're the best little boys.
I kind of feel like you have to write a children's book about interfaith called Latka and Kofta.
I should. I'm going to steal that. I'll give you some credit, yeah. But yeah.
What is one thing people don't know about Muslim Americans?
We're very diverse in our thinking. We're not a monolith. And Muslims showed this past election in 2024 that, they vote for people on the left, they vote for people on the right, that their votes can change, they're up for grabs in some places. We're very different people, and we can use that to help change minds and bring more people to the pro-America, pro-peace side.
What is your favorite curse?
Oh my God. Am I allowed to say it?
Yeah, of course. Oh my God. You have to say it with passion.
Cunt.
Oh my God.
I'm going to get so canceled. Oh my God. Thank you for canceling me.
Okay, but there's a story there because you did ask, am I allowed to say it? Yeah.
So when I'm driving, I am not the same person. When I'm out here, I'm doing interfaith work. I'm like speaking to Jews, Muslim, Hindus, Christians. I love everybody, right? My whole thing is empathy, respect, care. Listening to people, being super empathetic, almost to a fault. But when I'm driving, not the same thing. That C word, see you next Tuesday. You cut me off, I'm going to cut you off right back. I'm going to find a way. I'm going to dedicate the rest of my drive to finding a way around you to cut you off too. So one of my things is I want to get into stand-up.
What you just said is that you... like myself, you are a Middle Eastern driver.
Absolutely.
So you want to get into stand-up?
I want to get into stand-up, and that's one of my bits because I was telling this to my friend, and he thought it was absolutely hilarious. So I started writing it down on my phone about like how I'm like a nicer person on the outside, but then when I'm driving, there's like a whole thing I wrote on my phone about it. But it's very true. That is the C word. Oh my God, even coming here, there were some terrible drivers. I was cut off by a dump truck. I was going the speed limit down whatever road comes here from the highway, and a dump truck gets in front of me, and I'm like, there's a billion lanes to get into. And he chose to get into the lane of the person going, for legal purposes, the speed limit.
So I have to say, you're allowed to say this. Okay. The dump truck driver probably is Islamophobic. Unless your wife was driving and then he's anti-Semitic.
Yeah, I think he was definitely Islamophobic. He saw a Middle Eastern man and he was like, I'm going to ruin his day.
When was the last time you cried?
Last time I cried? Another difference between like my wife and I, my wife is not afraid to cry. She's very open with her emotions. She wishes that I was as well, but I really don't cry that much. Last time I cried was, I think, 2021 when my mom passed away.
Oh, mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
It was a rough time, and that was really the last time I cried. I haven't cried since. Also, another thing, I don't throw up. I can smell the worst thing. I can eat the worst thing. I don't cry and I don't throw up because I'm not a baby. But yeah, I don't get nauseous or anything. It's just the two things I don't do. I don't know. I just don't cry that much.
I would say there are different things that differentiate between myself and a baby, mostly diapers. If you could be invited over for Shabbat dinner with any Jewish person in history, dead or living, who would that be?
That's an amazing question. I would say my wife's grandparents. They passed away like 10 years ago, so I never got to meet them. And they sound like amazing people. And I say that God takes the people that you like most first. So my family, we loved our mom more than my dad. Like, sorry, dad, but yeah, we loved her. She was so sweet and kind and cute and nurturing. But, you know, she was taken first. And it's like that with Jocelyn's grandparents on her mom's side, her Baba and Dieda. They were taken first, unfortunately. They were a little bit older than the grandparents on her dad's side. They weren't in the best health, and yeah, it eventually caught up with them, and she lost them. And I wish I could be there, like all of us, like the grandparents on the father's side, the mother's side, the mom and dad, me and her, like even Lak and Gulf, to bring them into like a whole giant family Shabbat dinner would have been so nice. I've been to tons, like more than 100 Shabbat dinners with my wife's parents and grandparents. So nice. It would have meant a lot to me.
What is your favorite holiday?
Christmas. I love Christmas.
This is, I have to say, it's so on brand. You're Muslim, your wife is Jewish, and yet you love Christmas.
We love Christmas in our house. My wife and I, we never had Christmas trees growing up. Mm. Raised Muslim, raised Jewish. No one had a Christmas tree. So when we moved in together in 2020, one of the first things we did that year was buy a Christmas tree from Costco. Mm-hmm. And it lights up. It does everything. We keep the cats away from it. I love Christmas. I loved Christmas movies as a kid.
What's your favorite one?
Favorite one is The Last Action. No, I'm saying Last Action. That's another Arnold movie. What is it called? It's an Arnold movie.
You're supposed to say Die Hard, but...
Okay, Die Hard's good too. It's an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. I almost said The Last Action here, but that's a different one. I don't remember the name of it, but it's an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie where he like forgets that it's Christmas Eve and his son wanted an action figure. And it's very run-of-the-mill, low-budget, low-quality Arnie movie from like the 90s. It's so Christmas, and looking at it as an adult, I'm like, the set for like that movie, terrible. The acting, except for Arnold, terrible. But it just makes me so happy. It's so nostalgic.
The acting, except for Arnold, terrible. I don't know if that's going to hold. What is your least favorite holiday?
My least favorite holiday? Oh my God. I would say New Year's. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. When do you feel safest?
I feel safest when I'm with my family.
When do you feel least safe?
That's an interesting question, because I never feel super unsafe. Even when I was in the military and I was doing security operations, or I was up for like 36 hours straight. It's just, I think that's a fault in my brain, because I need that for survival purposes. Like evolutionarily, I need to feel unsafe at times to live. And people have evolved to feel that way. But trying to think about it, and it's, I just really can't think of an answer to give you.
What gives you hope?
People around me give me hope. I don't get hope from Instagram comments or stuff like that. It's when people show up in person. I went to a counter protest in Brooklyn like 2 weeks ago. Tons of people there, and the pro-Israel side was amazing. We were dancing, we were laughing, we were like jumping up and down, singing. It was fantastic. That gave me a lot of hope.
Finally, every episode, I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel, the Jewish diaspora, or the world in general. Where would you want people to donate to this week?
I'm not sure. I would say this podcast. Like, absolutely. We need more conversations like this where, you know, you have somebody come in and we talk and listen to each other. We get to know each other. This is fantastic. I would say donate to this podcast.
Thank you. I'd say so too. Dan, where can people find you?
They can find me on Instagram at It's Dan Khan.
It's Dan Khan.
So yep, it's fun. Dan Khan. Normal spelling.
ITSDANKHAN.
Oh, underscore between its and Dan.
You see?
But
okay.
That's it.
ITS underscore DANKHAN.
That's perfect. Yeah. Instagram and I think that's really it. Yeah.
Where can we find American Peace Committee?
American Peace Committee is also on Instagram. It's APC_US.
All right. Well, it's been a real pleasure. Make sure to invite me to your stand-up gigs.
Yeah, absolutely.
And more important, to your interfaith meetings. I'd love to come and disagree.
Of course. Yeah.
And I'm just happy to say, here I am with Dan Kahn.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at The Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."